But we're going to use that as an excuse to see this Cartan formalism in action. So Anna and I dug out an old handout, and this is simply so that as we get into the meat of the calculation, I don't want you sort of spending your time worrying about copying every last index down accurately. So instead, you have that in front of you in the handout, hopefully with correct, correct alpha and correct indices, so that you can just sit and focus on seeing the calculation in action. Because, you know, although the example that we'll be applying it to is a very straightforward metric, one of the powerful aspects of the Cartan formalism is that you can deal with things in a lot of generality. So we're looking at something very specific, but it would be quicker to put it on an algebraic manipulation program if you knew what you were doing. It would probably take you longer to learn how to use the algebraic manipulation program. But typically, what you can't do with computer programs is deal with things in generality. So deal with arbitrary dimensions, or look if you want to look at arbitrary curvature on a particular sort of subcomponent of the metric. So that's really why it's useful to be acquainted with this formalism. And also I'm quite a fan of it because it enables you to very quickly anywhere access what, you know, something that you need to know. The other thing it does, I think, is that it builds up in you an intuition about patterns. So typically when you're trying to solve some physical problem, you usually translate it into some sort of calculation or a model, and then you work with the model. But knowing whether or not you've made a mistake somewhere in the middle of your calculation, it's usually quite hard to be 100% accurate. And so as you do things more and more, you build up this knowledge of patterns and what you expect things to look like. And so that's something which is valuable by getting this hands-on experience. Okay, so we're applying the formalism to a spherically symmetric static situation. So I'm not going to go through all the handout, but at the start of the handout, I've shown a little bit about how you use these killing symmetries to reduce degrees of freedom of the metric. So here, the static part means that there's a killing vector, d by dt, and t goes to minus t is a symmetry. So that's what it means to have something being static, and then spherically symmetric means that you've got an SO3 algebra of killing vectors. So in other words, you've got that's your SO3 algebra. So the commutator of two of your killing vectors is plus or minus the third. And so that tells you that you can pick coordinates. There are surfaces in your geometry which are invariant, which are of dimension less than or equal to 3. That's what this is saying. There's a theorem that tells you if you have a set of vectors that close under the Lie bracket, then they span a surface of dimension less than or equal to the number of vectors. In this case, we know that we're looking for a theta and phi, which correspond to two spheres on which our metric doesn't change. So that's our intuition. So our metric, we're going to write it in the form We're going to say that the SO3 gives us this unit two-sphere metric multiplied by some function. The fact that it's static tells us these functions don't depend on time. The time symmetry part is going to say that we've just got a dt squared here, and so all that's left is our radial coordinate. So I've written it down there in slightly more generality than we need, because I could choose a gauge for my coordinates. I could fix one of these three functions, but for the moment, I'm just going to leave it general, so that we can see how the patterns build up with the connection and the curvature. So the reason being that you will have seen it where you write this as r squared, but sometimes it's convenient to leave that as a general function, okay? So we want to apply Cartan, which means that we have to go through a set of steps. So first of all, we want to identify an orthonormal basis so that our connection one forms are anti-symmetric. So that's really easy to do in this case because our metric is block diagonal. So all we have to do is take the basic coordinate basis for our covector space, which would be dt, dr, d theta, d phi, and then we multiply by an appropriate weighting factor so that our metric is now simply the omega t tensor omega t plus omega r tensor omega r. Now I'm hatting the indices here to emphasize the fact that we're referring here to this orthonormal basis, because normally we might write sort of VT to be the T component of a vector. So I'm kind of making it clear that this hatted index is labeling an element of the cotangent orthonormal basis. Okay, so that was easy. So now all we have to do is differentiate. So if I look at d of omega t, d squared is 0, so the only thing that the exterior derivative can act on is this function a, so I get a prime dr wedge dt, but I want to express that in terms of the basis, so I see that that is a primed over ab. And I've just swapped the ordering of T and R there. So I simply do that for all of them. D omega R is 0 because B depends only on R. So if I take a derivative, I'd get dr wedge dr. Similarly, I can read off D omega theta is minus C prime over CB, omega theta cross omega R, in direct analogy with the T. And then the only one where a little more goes on is the phi. So I get C prime sine theta dr cross d phi. And then I've also got to differentiate the sine theta piece. And so I get two terms. And again, I'm going to rearrange those. Right, so I've taken the derivative of my basis, and the reason I wanted to do that is because Cartan's first equation tells me that the connection one forms are related to the exterior derivative of my basis vectors. So that was why I actually did that reordering, because this would tell me, if I do the T one in detail, so D of omega T, yep. Because we're looking for the metric connection. We're trying to compute in Einstein gravity the a solution to the spherically symmetric Einstein equation. So we're looking for the Einstein connection here and the Einstein curvature. So I'm taking the torsion to zero. Yep, fair point. And I'm also looking for the metric connection as well, because that's what I've, you know, that's what we derived this formalism for. So if I now compare this to the expression I've just derived, then I can see that if I sort of look at how to match up the left-hand side here and the right-hand side, that I just have simply a theta TR which is A primed on AB omega T. So theta TR wedge omega R. So all I'm doing is peeling off that omega R, and the free index there is the T. So, yep.
So while you're saying, for example, that theta, T, theta, or phi are zero, right?
Yes, but because otherwise there would be thetas and phis up there.
Sure, but I can choose those connection one forms to be proportional to d theta or d phi.
Yes, you could. But then you'd have to come and look at d of omega theta there. So, for example, I'll put it in as an aside. So d omega theta hat then would be minus theta, would contain, let's say, a theta t wedge omega t, which would now be non-zero. So, you know, in this case, I'm saying that because everything's block diagonal and fairly straightforward, it's actually doing the obvious thing is doing the right thing in this case. But, you know, in principle, what you're really doing is like a set of simultaneous equations and inverting from d omega a to these matrices here, theta a b. But because everything is fairly straightforward, you can actually sort of more or less just read it off. So this would be what would go wrong if you tried to do that. So an instance that almost every metric that you tend to be working with it's not necessarily as easy as this, but it's not so much more complicated. So there may be instances where you do have to think a little bit more about inverting the relation, but usually it's not on the whole space. It might be on some particular subspace where there's off-diagonal terms in the metric.
So in principle, I should take the connection one form expanded in the orthonormal base that I have, and I'll have a set of equations that will give me exactly what you're saying.
Yes. So that's what strictly speaking, you're doing. You're inverting a set of algebraic equations. It's simply that they're very simple in this case, and so you read them off. And in almost in just about every situation that you meet, it is actually almost exactly this simple. I think that's kind of. It's not that I've chosen a ridiculously simple case to illustrate this. This is actually fairly representative. You've got to go quite a long way to get something disgusting. I can think of one, but. Okay, so having sort of laid out the stall in detail for this one, I'm just going to sort of proceed by analogy. So if I, again, it's again one of these things of just seeing something by eye in the sense that having seen the structure of that equation, looked at the answers that you've got, which are fairly straightforward, you can see that what I've written down solves that matrix equation and that all the other connection components must vanish. So that's the connection in this orthonormal basis. So then I apply Cartan's second equation. And I'm looking for the curvature two forms. And for our Einstein metric connection, these are also anti-symmetric on A and B. So I need to consider six possibilities. I'm in four dimensions. So that tells me there are six possibilities for RAB. So again, I'll do the first one carefully. So this is what I get if I'm looking for the TR curvature two form. And the first term is just taking D of theta TR. Now the second term, which is theta wedge theta, if I look at whether I can get anything non-zero, only non-zero component here is if A is R, but the only non-zero component of theta AR is if A is T, theta, or phi. So that second term vanishes. So all I have to do is take the exterior derivative of the first connection one form that I worked out. So it's the exterior derivative of this. So I input what I've got, and I'm now writing my omega t as a dt. So once again, I don't get anything if I act on dt. And I just take the derivative of this function, a primed on b. So I've expanded out that derivative, and I've rewritten things back in the orthonormal basis. I've done two steps there. So the I've sort of put that in full detail, but you can see the idea of what's going on. If I replace t by theta, I'm basically going to get the same sort of procedure, but with c instead of a and theta instead of t. So I'm going to get this corresponding expression. Now I'll have to think a little bit more about the phi component. Because when I look at phi r, I've got a sine theta in there. But I've also got to think about my cross terms. And now I notice that if I put a equals theta hat, then this connection one forms proportional to omega phi, and this connection one form is proportional to omega theta. So I can get something non-zero in the product of my connection one forms. So I've got both expressions there. So the first term gives me the piece that I would expect from the radial derivative. I then get a derivative with respect to theta. Then for the second term, theta phi theta hat is cot theta over c omega phi hat. But now I just have to think when I ask what is this term, well, I've got it written down. I was thinking I'd reverse the order, but I haven't. So I get three pieces. I've got the radial derivative here, the derivative with respect to theta, and the cross term. But if I now look a bit more closely at these last two pieces, I've got a c primed over b. Here it's cos theta d phi, whereas here it's cot theta over c squared, omega phi cross omega theta. If I re-express these in terms of my orthonormal basis, that cancels out the c squared sine theta. And so what this gives me is cos theta d phi d theta, whereas here I've got cos theta d phi. And so these two terms cancel because they're the same but with the opposite sign because the order of the wedge product is reversed. And so I simply end up with this same pattern of a derivative of the C function. So that's three of the six done. Yeah, because the metric itself, as we've derived it, is only dependent on the radial coordinate. So all of the so all of these functions all contain some arbitrary A, B, or C as a function of R. There's also, coming along for the ride, there's the structure of the two-sphere as well. So if you just forget about the sine theta for the moment, you're looking at things which are just functions of R. And so kind of what you expect, if you look at the, if you think about the connection one forms, you would expect that nothing to happen with the R, because everything's dependent on R, but for the other, in the other indices, you would expect, since the, for example, so omega t is ADT, the only thing it can contain is when you differentiate with respect to R. So you would only expect a sort of TR connection one form there. And so when you took the curvature, you would kind of therefore just expect an omega t and an omega R, because that's kind of the only functional dependence going on there. Now, what's happening with the theta piece is you've got this two-sphere. So you've got your SO3 symmetry. So you've got these invariant two spheres, surfaces of symmetry in your manifold. And you really would expect that they would somehow have a lot, you know, that this S2 structure is going to kind of carry its way, you know, leave its imprint in the connection and in the curvature. But what you don't expect it to do is to mix with the T and the R coordinate, right? So if there was, here we're looking at phi R, so this is telling us something about what's happening in the R direction to these angular components. So you would expect these two to look very similar, because the fact it's got SO3 symmetry is saying that, you know, you can rotate on the sphere, it should look the same. So it shouldn't really be different for the theta than the phi. So that's kind of why they look the same. But, you know, as we go on, we'll sort of see where the S2 sort of hides in the full Riemann tensor. So here, for the T theta, there's no connection one form, T theta connection one form. So we have to just look at the cross products. And so here I have to take A as R. And so now, I have to just, since I've calculated, I've written down rather theta, the connection one form with, in the order theta R, I have to just sort of swap those two indices. And in order to do this, I have to lower the R index. I have to swap the order. And then I have to raise the theta index. So I'm saying this is not equal in the sense of obviously I'm shifting indices around. I'm using the fact that G A hat B hat is eta A hat B hat here. So when I raise an R theta or phi hat index, I get a minus sign. And when I swap the order here, I get a minus sign because the connection one forms are anti-symmetric in an orthonormal basis. So putting in this, I see that I get an A primed on AB, a C primed on CB, and an omega T and an omega theta. So I put all of those pieces of information together. And then I can see that the same thing happens for the phi angle, because it's structurally the same.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate again on why raising and lowering the hat indices is 8AB? I guess my confusion is that I thought we defined like the product of an omega with an E to be a chronicle delta instead of
omega. Oh, this is saying that the components of the metric. So in other words, if I take G of, right. So my metric here, G, is omega t hat tensor omega t hat, etc. So it's saying that if I write things with this orthonormal basis, then I just have plus or minus one in terms of raising and lowering these hatted indices. So it's like saying that the you know, to raise and lower hatted indices, you use the orthogonal Lorentz metric, Minkowski metric, sorry. Mm-hmm.
So the connection is not a connection, right? So when we raise and lower the indices, is it kind of just a formal thing, like when we write theta with the two lower indices?
Yeah, so it's, if you remember when I did, remember I said if we chose an orthonormal basis, then the connection one forms were symmetric. In that instance, I think I was using the fact that, I'm trying to remember the argument now. So I had G of EA, EB, and then I looked at that. I then took the covariant derivative of this, and then I had things with, you know, gammas, so I had expressions like that, and then I had my connection one forms with, you know, with component, and I used the metric to the sort of components of the metric to raise and lower those connection one form indices. So it's kind of using something about this. It's using the fact that you know, the omegas are, because we've got the metric, we can identify vectors and covectors. So we can think of them as being, you know, we can say, well, you know, this EA is equivalent to omega A. So ET is equivalent to omega T. And if, and I kind of use the Minkowski metric to raise and lower indices. Maybe getting there. So you're right, the A hat and B hat are not necessarily tensor indices, but you can, you know, algebraically, you can make this association with, you know, or formally of at least sort of saying, well, if I consider my connection with indices downstairs, what does it look like? And then I would use eta AB to raise and lower indices. And this is kind of sort of feeding back to if we were doing standard GR in a coordinate basis and we were looking at connection components, then we would, although that would, strictly speaking, in that context, be abstract index, we would be raising and lowering with the metric there. So it's saying that if I, you know, it's kind of, to be consistent, you know, if I want to identify a particular basis vector, E theta, with a covector omega theta, I kind of need to use eta to do that. So, sort of, that sort of thing. So where was I up to? I think I've got 5 of the 6, so the only one left to do, 5 theta. So for the last one, I take a derivative of theta phi theta. I then got my cross terms. And so if I put all this together, I find that I end up with something which is just dependent on the phi and the theta. So this one sitting in here, or the 1 over c squared, this is the sort of S2 curvature part. So this is where the 2 sphere is showing up. The rest of it, things like c prime, this is where you're seeing the impact of the fact that these 2 spheres are sitting inside a 4-dimensional space, and the size of the 2 spheres is changing as you move out in the radial direction. So this is a scaling factor times the 2-sphere curvature, and this piece is telling you about the 4-dimensional part of the 2-sphere curvature. So the final part is to find the Riemann tensor from this. So I use the fact that the curvature 2 forms were expressed in terms of components of the Riemann tensor, and then I look at what the curvature 2 forms are, and I can see that I can just read them off. So for example, the one I'm just writing down now, t theta, t theta, if I look over here, my two form, rt theta, has only omega t and omega theta there. So that tells me the only non-zero component is t theta, t theta. And I read that off as that function minus a prime c prime over a b squared c. And I can see it's the same for the phi. And then the last piece. So it's sort of, it is actually fairly straightforward, just reading these off. But I suppose it's just kind of convincing yourself it is that straightforward. So these are the components of the Riemann tensor. But now you see why I've been hatting these indices all the way through. These are the components of the Riemann tensor in the orthonormal basis. So in other words, my Riemann tensor R would be given by contracting with this orthonormal basis. So this is what I mean. It's Riemann in an orthonormal basis. What we usually want is Riemann in a coordinate basis. And so in order to get this in a coordinate basis, I have to look at EA hat mu, the components of EA in the coordinate basis and the components of omega in the coordinate basis. So you see that we're going to pick up factors of A, B, C, and C sine theta when we actually do that. So I won't go into detail, but for example, TR is going to equal so in this case, it's going to equal B squared times the orthonormal expression because I have to include a B for every R index downstairs. Sometimes it's just easier, though, if we want to do the Einstein equations, to just read off the Ricci tensor by simply keeping one index upstairs, one index downstairs, because then these weights, these factors, cancel out. So if I want to know what my TT Ricci component is, I just look at anything with two T's in it. So I've got the top line there, the Riemann TRTR. And then I've also got the bottom one, which is T theta, and T phi, T phi. And so you can see that there's an overall factor of this one and B squared. So I just add those up. For the theta, or the angular pieces, they're both going to be the same. So the first piece is coming from R, theta R. The second piece picks up the bottom line where I've got T, theta T, theta. And then finally, I've got to add phi theta, phi theta. Got a sign there. So I go through and just write down, sort of extract what my components are, Ricci components, and now I can write down my Einstein tensor, and I'll do that, but basically what I want to emphasize is what we've done here on these boards with relatively little effort, in the sense that the differentiation is easy, and we've kind of just gone through and picked things off from a formula, is we've computed the Riemann curvature of the space-time that we want, and we actually made it more complicated than we needed to at the beginning. So if I write down my Einstein tensor, okie dokie. So the purpose of this is, so I think it's always valuable, you know, once you've seen a particular method or a particular formalism being introduced, actually applying it for yourself can be quite a different matter. You sit there in the lecture, you think, yeah, I've got all that. And then you sit down trying to do something, and it can be a slightly different matter. And so I think it's always valuable to kind of see somebody sweating their way through doing something so that when you come to do it, you've seen the process. And you've also seen, as you've gone through it, which bits you found were more of the sticking points and which bits were the easier points. And so if you come to go through it now, you know, you've sort of already had seen how to get through the more sticky points. So it's, as I say, I made the metric slightly more complicated than necessary. But even so, this is, it's really an awful lot easier than trying to calculate each individual Levi-Civita connection component and then going through and putting that in the formula for the Riemann and trying to find that out. So that, you know, that's a bit of a nightmare unless, again, you get Mathematica to do it for you. So gauge, remember I sort of said that we tended to use some concepts or terminology from gauge theory. Gauge in GR is choice of coordinates. And here we have two, well, We have a few obvious ones. We could set B equal to 1. And in that case, R would equal proper radial distance. That's one thing we could do. We could set A equals 1 over B. Sometimes that's a useful thing to do. Or, and this is what we'll do, C equals R. And this is known as area gauge because the area of a two-sphere is 4 pi R squared. So when we write C equals R, R is not the proper distance from the origin. It's simply telling us about the area of spheres. So hidden behind that gauge choice is the fact that it is actually consistent with equations of motion. So it does actually imply some energy conditions on your energy momentum tensor, but they're satisfied by normal matter. So let's choose the area gauge. Then my Einstein equation, the TT component, is actually something that we can notionally at least integrate up. The left-hand side can be expressed as a total derivative. And so I can write, my Einstein equation in terms of a derivative of an unknown function b. So I think you have seen this before. But it's quite a nice way of deriving this static spherically symmetric solution, where I'm defining this function m of r is going to be simply this integral. That should be an r squared, actually. It's the integral of 4 pi r squared t naught naught. Now, given that t naught naught is usually like an energy density, this is our intuitive notion of the mass inside the sphere. So it's an intuitive notion, but it's sort of at least at a linearized level around Newtonian gravity, it does make sense. So it's like you can't really make this complete, strictly correct in GR, but it's good enough. It's intuitively our mass inside radius r. So now let's look at the RR equation, which also does not contain a second derivative. So I now know what 1 over b squared is, at least, you know, in terms of this function m of r. And so I can write down my other unknown metric function a in terms of this m of r and also of the pressure. Put a little r there, so it's the radial pressure. I'm going to say that's going to be the same as the azimuthal pressures, but it just might help to distinguish it from my rows. So at the moment, although it looks nice, we can't solve it because we need an equation of state. We need to know what p is, but we could either look at our final Einstein equation, Or we could look at conservation of energy momentum. And so that's grad of T is zero. And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to use my orthonormal basis, since I've computed my connection components in the orthonormal basis. So for example, I know that things that I'll need, gamma TTR is A primed on AB. Now this is equal to actually gamma TRT and gamma theta theta R is C primed on CB. So again, we use C as R and we know what B is. And now I look at the R components. Let's write it here. So my covariant derivative is a partial derivative plus two connection pieces here. And so if I read these off, I've got a P primed. Here I've got if I look at my gamma AAR, I've got A primed over AB. So that's the T term. Then my C primed over CB is just 1 over RB. And I've got two of those. Then the final piece, so I've got an A primed over AB row from the 0, 0 components. And then I've got from the theta and phi components, assuming that all my pressures, I'm assuming I've got an isotropic fluid. So these pieces cancel. And so I've now got conservation of energy momentum giving me a relation between P primed and P. And here I've got a relation of A primed to P and M. So this system, looking at the equations of motion for a star, is known as the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff set of equations. And I gather you looked at this in the first general relativity course. What I'd like to just finish off with today is to write down an analytic solution to these equations, which also illustrates in a very simplistic and naive way what you actually derived in a homework, which is that there is a limit to how big a star you can build. So I think you will have done this in more detail because you had time while thinking about your homework. I'm just going to do something very quick and very dirty here today, but something that you can write down analytically. So we're going to model our star by a top hat potential. Which means that we're going to set rho as a constant inside some radius and zero outside. So that's why it's called top hat. So we can say, therefore, our M of R function so inside the star, our mass increases like R cubed. Outside, it's a constant. If I look at my energy conservation equation, so I can see my energy conservation equation is given by P primed is minus rho plus P into A primed on A, but A primed on A is given by that middle relation here. It's come from the R equation. So if I just read it off, that's having read off what A primed on A is. Okay, so I've just sort of rearranged factors, but here I can see that this is a nonlinear first-order differential equation. I've related P prime to constant rho naught, some powers of R, and this P function itself. So that looks slightly messy, but in fact, it has an analytic solution. So I don't expect that to be blindingly obvious, but it is true, and it is tailored so that P tends to zero as R tends to capital R. So the pressure has to vanish outside the star, and it has to be continuous. So I just want to note that P of zero can be calculated. So this is the central pressure of the star. And if I look at that, my central pressure tends to infinity when R equals 9 gm over 4. So what this is saying is that you can only, given a particular density, you can only build a star of limited size. You can't just sort of carry on. Eventually, this solution will break down. When the central pressure becomes infinite, that means you've hit some sort of singularity, this of the solution. It's saying something's badly defined. Now, things go wrong before then, and this is a very simple model, but the beauty of it is that it's just an analytic model. You can write down the solution, an exact solution to Einstein's equations with this particular set of assumptions about your matter source, and it's saying that there's a problem. You can't build an infinitely large star. And so you've seen this in the homework and in the first course as under the guise of a Chandrasekhar limit. So no matter what you do, you try and introduce more realistic equations of state, introduce all the possible interactions that you can have in the core of the star, there's still not enough. Eventually, once a star, if it's too heavy, once it's run out of fuel, it will eventually collapse, and it will form outside the solution that this looks like outside capital R, which is the Schwarzschild solution, and that's a black hole. So what we're going to do tomorrow is we'll look at the black hole solutions, and we'll show how to write them down or encode their causal structure in a particularly nice manner known as Penrose diagrams, and we'll also look at black holes in a slightly more general range of scenarios.